Hello and welcome to the Sunflower Allotment Podcast. This is a podcast for anybody and everybody interested in allotments. And today, bees.
Yes. We've got a fabulous guest for today's episode, an old friend of Tim's who's a very experienced beekeeper and all-round good egg.
Yeah, it was a wonderful conversation with him, wasn't it, earlier on in the week, and I felt... as I was listening to it, that I wanted to get a beehive. I don't know about you. I know you're very allergic, Peter, but I was thinking, I'm going to get one. And then he started to talk a bit more about it. I thought, well, maybe I don't have the time commitments, but it sounds like an amazing hobby. And along with the other things you spoke about, like the environmental impacts of growing flowers, I thought it was a fascinating conversation.
It was brilliant to hear that wider context around pollinators and supporting the other species that aren't catered to as much as honeybees. Yeah, perhaps it did the opposite for me, because I've always wanted to keep bees, and when I got the allotment, I thought, now I'm going to give it a go. But I am, and I was started being a kind of apprentice to one of the beekeepers on the allotment, and then one day I'm very allergic to bee stings, and one day he had a very angry hive that he had collected from a commercial grower, and he had a brand new suit on, I had a suit on. And he said, just stay away. And all I heard was the bluest of languages.
Oh, dear.
Which I won't repeat here, but the air turned blue. And I thought, and he's a really experienced beekeeper, getting stung through a brand new suit. And I thought, perhaps I won't keep bees after all.
Yes, it might be a wise
but
decision.
But if you too, then I'm right behind you in the car park. And
Ken goes on to say that he used to wear a boiler suit underneath his beekeeping suit. Anyway, let's get on with the interview that we had. And thanks again, Ken. And I hope everybody enjoys it. Welcome, Ken, to the Sunflower Allotment Podcast. It's a real pleasure to have you joining us. We wanted to ask you questions about bees on the plot, bees on the allotment, because there are some people who do keep bees. And also just for me, I love to have bees buzzing around while I'm working and was interested about attracting bees. So we thought we'd ask you a range of questions, if that's okay. So, thanks very much for joining.
Pleasure. I'm a listener of the podcast.
Oh, yay.
So We should ask you what your favourite episode is now, just to test you.
Tour around Rachel's allotment.
Oh, well, thanks.
Oh, wow.
I have to say, I mean, I'm a fan.
Oh, thanks. I'll tell the chickens.
I like to, because I had an allotment. When was it? When did I get an allotment? Over 15 years ago now, I had my first allotment and my only allotment, and I had to give it up. I guess not long afterwards in allotment time, like it was only a few years afterwards. But I loved it. And I was listening to the first 7 days. And that brought me right back to when I first got my allotment in Bristol. And I've worked in gardens and stuff since, and created a couple of community gardens. But it's nothing quite like an allotment. It's a very different, special space.
Yeah.
Totally agree, Ken. They are very, very special. And I'd love to hear more about the community gardens, and the things that you're doing now, because it seems such an interesting way to develop a life in and around gardening. But we'd better get on, I guess, with talking about bees. I'm super allergic to bee stings. One bee sting might see me off. So I'm fascinated in keeping bees. I did want to keep bees until the guy who kept bees next to me on the plot. Various experiences put me off. So my first question, and for someone who can't keep bees but would love to, is just generally in terms of what is so good about bees in terms of what do they do for allotments, for gardening, in general, rather than getting straight into beekeeping, a more general question.
Well, I mean, I got into beekeeping because I had to give up my allotment. I moved from Bristol to London. It was impossible to get an allotment in London at the time, and probably still is. And although well worth putting your name on a list, I would never discourage anyone from trying. So bees were kind of a way to be connected to gardens, trees, the natural world. In a very small space, you need a meter squared to keep a hive of bees, and then all of a sudden you're a livestock farmer with 50,000 head of cattle, as I've heard one beekeeper describe it, which is a nice sort of analogy to farming. And it is, you're responsible for 50,000 individual bees, which is great and fascinating. And I did it. I was motivated by my concern for what was happening to the wider environment and the importance of bees and pollinators to our countryside, to gardening, to our food system. And they do, they pollinate, honeybees pollinate a third of all food crops. And I think something like two thirds, I mean, there's probably a more precise figure, but two thirds of crops need pollinating by something and not necessarily honeybees. Feel free to correct that in the comments. Those stats, it's important. That's what you need to remember. But I mean, I've kept bees now as well since so just a year before I met Tim. So that's 10 years I've been a beekeeper. And I've also kept bees in sort of a kind of, I mean, there's the, I started off as a hobbyist with two hives. And then at my peak, I had 12 hives, which is still very much a hobby, but it's a pretty serious hobby once you've got 12 hives. Although there are some serious economies of scales. And once you've got two, firstly, you'll end up with 12 at some point because that's the way beekeeping goes. And secondly, it's not actually as much work as you would think that each time you add a hive. But what I would say is, firstly, I know there are people that are very allergic that keep bees. Famously, Martha Carney is
Yeah,
in a
nice.
has a has a bee allergy and keeps bees. But if it depends on what you want, why you want to keep the bees, and if it's to connect to that natural world, if it's to help an animal that is under enormous pressure from the way that we treat the countryside, then there's actually lots of other ways you can do it without keeping bees. And I think actually I definitely don't regret keeping bees, but if I were to revisit this decision, I probably wouldn't keep bees. Although I don't know, it's a really tricky one. If you want to help the environment, keeping honeybees is not the way to do it, is probably the short answer. And there's several reasons for that. One, honeybees are not as under threat as other pollinators, and that's really saying something. It shows you that the bar is really low, and honeybees are under threat. We've destroyed habitat in the countryside. We've used lots of agrochemicals and pesticides, which affect their life cycle. But we've got hundreds and hundreds of years of looking after honeybees, experience around the world. And honeybee numbers have stayed surprisingly stable. It's something you see in the media a lot, is that honeybees are in decline. In fact, they're not. And that's because we're good at producing more honeybees. But what that means is that us producing more honeybees is putting even more pressure on the pollinators, all the other bees, all the other the important wasps, flies. That we don't know how to help as well. We don't know how to support as well as we do the honeybee. And in fact, the honeybees are competing with those other pollinators, some of which arguably you could say are more important. Some of them have very close relationships with individual species of plants, and honeybees can compete with them. So if you want to help the environment, the best thing you can do is plant flowers and write to your local politician, which sounds a bit dry, but lobbying and supporting civil society to advocate for the bees and for all the pollinators is also something really important. But I'm just going to keep rambling on. Tim can
Wow,
edit that out.
fascinating.
Is that
Really
right?
fascinating. Yeah, no,
Yeah.
it's kind
What?
of the before we got into beekeeping, it was exactly the kind of information that I'm really interested to hear. So it's fantastic to hear you talking so what widely before we get into the details. So thank you, Ken. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
Carry
yeah, there's.
on. That's I'm all for advocacy for all the pollinators, and that sounds a brilliant thing to do. And it would
Yeah, there's.
never occurred to me to write to the MP, but I will.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, if you think about the situation with neonicotinoids, which are a pesticide that are actually coated around lots of seeds and distributed, and sown in fields on an enormous scale, and they have a big impact. And that's been a debate which has been very live, partly because of Brexit, and they were banned by the European Union. The UK actually supported that ban, if I remember correctly, and now they're rowing back on it. And so it's small issues, but well, they're not small issues. They're individual specific issues that have a big impact. And so you can just, yeah, neonics, Google neonics, write your MP and tell them that they're bad.
Yeah.
But on a more kind of cheerful level, yeah, you don't have to keep bees to really help bees and all the other pollinators as well. In fact, I think if you put your energies into planting lots of flowers wherever you can, then that would have an enormous impact. And also advocating, especially at the allotment scale, just reminding maybe your fellow allotmenters, I very much doubt that you three are using any chemicals on your plot, but there are some really bad stuff that's available in the garden centre, with sort of innocuous names, Roundup Ready. That doesn't actually affect bees, but it's a good example of something that is really damaging to the environment. You can buy as much as you like at the local garden centre.
Yeah,
Maybe not as much as you like, Rachel.
always seems shocking to me that no, you're right. We all try to be as organic and as right on as we can be, but I totally agree, Ken. It always seems shocking to me. You can buy any number of really unpleasant looking chemicals, which might keep your garden weed free or your drive, but it also seems anti nature in the extreme. We should have more
Yeah.
weed. We should let our drives grow over. And I'm encouraged to see, even on mainstream gardening programs, encouraged to let go having the immaculate lawn, and let things have borders which are left to grow wild, specifically for pollinators. So I hope that thinking is crossing over into more mainstream ideas about gardening nowadays. But it's a hard, an uphill battle for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I mean, I don't know how your allotment association works, but even at that level, talking about use of chemicals on the entire site, I don't know of any examples. It'd be interesting to find out if there are allotment associations that have banned use of chemicals on the entire site, and whether that's something, that could be something that people could think about talking about at that level.
Yeah, that's a really interesting idea, actually, even perhaps just sort of because our allotments are run by our local council, so it might be worth us even contacting our local council. And if enough people spoke up and said that we didn't want these things on our site, then they might start considering it and considering whether they could ban it.
Yes, well, we'll email our allotment officer. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ken, you spoke about planting flowers and how that can help. What flowers would you recommend the average, say the average, somebody like me who's doesn't know much about flowers and wants to attract as many pollinators as possible. Could you give me five or six flowers that I could go and get?
Ah, it worked. Hello, there you are. Andrew here, and this is Shandor.
Hello.
We've got a brand new season of the Family Histories podcast for you with another seven fascinating guests who'll be telling us about their secretive granny, a brave sailor, a political poet, a merchant seaman, a priestly lover, a resistance member, and a magnificent aunt that they've discovered in their family trees. And did I mention that there's a secret time machine? Nope, of course I didn't. Anyway, search for the Family Histories podcast after this episode to join us on our trip back in time. Okay, you can switch it off now. Uh-huh.
Well, I mean, it's probably stuff you're growing already. I have it because I visited Tim and Peter's allotment. And I remember we found a bumblebee nest on your plot, didn't we, Tim?
That's right, we did, yeah.
It's great. So, there's definitely flowers around. I mean, what's important is to think not necessarily about specific flowers, but when you're selecting stuff for your allotment, is to think about a range of flower shapes, and so that you are really kind of providing for the full spectrum of insects and pollinators that are out there. So you've got the kind of low to the ground open flowers like a strawberry. You know, strawberries are great; they need to be pollinated, and they're really accessible to a lot of pollinators. I love a nasturtium because you can do everything with everything. You know, you can eat the seeds, the leaves, the flowers. And if anyone likes eating nasturtium flowers, you know that you get that really sweet bit at the bottom, at the right at the back of the flower, the kind of little horn at the back. And that suits a really long-tongued pollinator. So that's for those specialists. Or some bees have worked out how to nibble away at the horn, so they don't have the long tongue, but they can nibble away at the horn and still get the sweet nectar, which is again really clever, and that's that's great. There are one thing that any kind of bean really, like a runner bean, it's great. I think I remember you said, Rachel, you've got a cardoon on your plot.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, I mean they're fantastic because they're huge landing pads, you know. Yeah. Again, if you grow carrots, you know, maybe let a couple of carrots go to seed. Because they produce also these big landing pads, you know, if you think about these kind of helicopter landing pads, and they're great for really small insects that get blown around in the wind a lot because they provide a big surface area. And if you walk, through the countryside and you see a cow pass or something, you'll often see, you know, five or six insects kind of just sat on there, you know, feeding away, having a rest. And they're really important as well. What I like is, you know, like, so you've got these different shapes of flowers. It's good to have a range. With the kind of strawberry at one end, nice and open, the nasturtium at the other, and then maybe some runner beans in the middle. It's kind of like flowers that aren't too deep but still require a little nose to get to the back to where the nectar is. And then you have like the strong flyers that can cope with, it's not a edible plant obviously, but a lot of people have verbena bonariensis in their gardens, and maybe some have, and they wave around in the wind, so you've got to be one of the stronger flyers to be able to land on that. And then again, you've got the kind of strawberries laid to the ground, which are really easy to land on. And then, you know, things like chives, all the herbs are great, really. You know, you've got rosemary, produces lovely little flowers. Chives are nice, and you can eat those as well. You can eat the flowers as well. So that's a nice one. And then I know you're planting some fruit trees, Tim. So that's obviously a great one. Some nice early pollen and nectar on the fruit trees for the and it's also, you know, thinking about through the year as well, flowering through the year. I don't know, is that helpful?
That's super helpful, yeah. And I was about to ask you whether you would recommend trying to plant flowers, different varieties that come into bloom at different times of the year, so you're sort of extending the feeding season. I wondered in line with that, I don't know much about the sort of life cycle of a lot of pollinators. So I try to sort of plant flowers for as much of the year as possible so that there's sort of a food source available. But I'm not really sure in the winter whether there are many things that would be requiring those flowers. But it's nice to have them anyway, just in case. But I don't know if you know much about that or could tell us a bit about it if you do.
Yeah, I mean, there's still insects out all year round, really, especially in the UK, because we don't get so cold that they can't go out. I mean, one thing that bees are quite good at is warming themselves up so they can fly at cooler temperatures. Honeybees do fly all year round. It's the thing that distinguishes them from all the other bees, is that they don't hibernate. So they're in the hive, they're awake, and they're generating lots of heat to keep the queen warm through the winter, so effectively, and themselves, but the aim is to keep the queen warm through the winter so she doesn't have to hibernate. And they will go out on small trips out, What one of the big challenges for beekeepers, for all of us really, but specifically around beekeepers, is climate change. And we're having this huge variability through the winter. So bees are out flying at times of year when they might not have flown quite as much before. So, you know, there are things that that can help them. On the community farm where I used to work and keep the bees, you know, we had a winter flowering, honeysuckle and things like that, which, you know, they smell amazing as well. So it's really nice to have something to have. I mean, all year round really, but the majority of bees and pollinators kind of emerge in the spring and then disappear again towards the end of the summer, some quite early in the summer. So there is obviously like an intense period from spring to end of summer. And into the autumn as well. One of the big things that I advocate for is leaving the ivy to flower.
Yes.
If you've got some ivy climbing up a tree or over your shed, it is an amazing source of pollen and nectar before these insects go into the much colder months. So definitely don't cut it back. Let it flower. And also it's surprisingly smells amazing. People can kind of. So I think a lot of people don't notice they're smelling it sometimes, and it's like that wonderful, fragrant smell in the autumn, and it's fantastic for the insects.
I would sort of hope that the more this sort of stuff's talked about, like as a gardener, quite often with my clients, they might ask me to do certain things like cut back their ivy, but I make it quite clear that I'm an organic sort of wildlife friendly gardener, so there are quite a few things that I refuse to do. So one of them is cutting back ivy, because I know that the flowers are such a rich source of food for all sorts of
animals. It's awful when you walk past like late September and someone's cutting back their ivy and you're like, oh, that's absolutely awful timing. Some people don't realize. So
no, hopefully the more people do, the more we all talk about it, hopefully more people will let things look a little bit scruffy if that's the way they see it. And
I mean, I just sort of reflecting, at the start of this, I didn't want to kind of discourage anyone from keeping bees if they're interested in keeping bees. Because there's so many benefits. It's you know, greatly enriched my life. So it's a wonderful thing to get into. But if you're interested in the environment and the ecology and that's your main drive, then there's loads of stuff you can do before you keep bees.
Thank you, Ken. I mean, that's been we've gone sideways a little bit, but that's been absolutely fascinating and great to have your knowledge. I've only recently learnt just how amazing insects are in the varieties of adaptations to their mouthpieces and the way they move to accessing different flowers. It's great to hear you talking about that. But I guess we should move on to keeping bees. And so you brought that up really nicely to take us back to that. I mean, what would be the first question we should ask? I mean, how, if you're interested in keeping bees, what are the first steps? What do you do? How do you get into it?
Well, I mean, I mean, you don't have to have your own bees. You know, you can do a lot of the things we talked about in terms of planting the flowers and supporting the local ecosystem, and then join your local beekeeping association. There's some fantastic local beekeeping associations all around the country, and they will have normally an apiary, which they either manage themselves or it's an apiary of one of the members that is used as a kind of teaching apiary. And then you can go along and help out with somebody else's bees. And it's hard work keeping bees, so no one's going to turn you down if you offer to lend a hand. And you can go and experience the bees, and there's lots of benefits to seeing inside the hive and sort of getting an insight into their world, because it is fascinating and very different to what we would experience in the rest of our lives. So that's I think a really good place to start, because then you'll also get a sense of whether you like it. Once you've got that, I mean, your association can also support you through getting set up. But essentially, it's a case of buying some bees and putting them in a hive and and then learning how to look after them. The, you know, the British Beekeeping Association offers some qualifications, and you can't even take the first level, the lowest level qualification, until you've kept bees for a year. And that really illustrates that you learn a lot from doing with beekeeping. And you can get the books, and there's lots of books, and they often disagree with each other, which is great fun. I mean, that's another fun thing about beekeeping, is there's lots of opinions, even more so than with gardening, and that's saying something, right? I really enjoy that aspect of it, actually, because there's a lot of debate around the best way to keep bees, and how natural to be, or how kind of interventionist to be. You know, there's a big debate around how much to intervene with the bees' lives, how much to feed them, whether to feed them or not, all that kind of stuff, whether to use some treatments for the pests and diseases that affect them or not. That's a really nice bit about beekeeping for me, is engaging with all those debates. In terms of the, because I remember you asked in the WhatsApp commitment, should I talk about that?
Yeah.
Yes, please.
Yeah, so it's a pretty big commitment, I'd say. It means you need to be, well, I would say it depends on how you're going to keep the bees, but I started keeping bees very much in line with the British Beekeeping Association's guidance around beekeeping. I was definitely at the more natural end of the spectrum. I didn't use lots of interventions, but I followed their approach, which requires you to inspect the bees once a week. You look inside the hive, you check how healthy they are, and you check how much honey they're producing, and you also check to see whether the queen is there, and you check to see whether the colony are thinking about swarming.
How can you tell if a colony is thinking about swarming?
They give you pretty clear indications, actually. They start to produce queen cups, which are the queen larvae are put in cups or cells that look very different to the way that the rest of the bee larvae are reared. I think probably most people are familiar with the honeycomb that you see. So that's how in those cells larvae are normally reared, all the workers and the drones. Drones are the male bees, workers are all female bees. And the queen bee, when she's reared, she's forms in a thimble or a kind of peanut shape on the comb itself. So once you see one of those, that's a really clear indication that the bees are planning on swarming. And her development follows kind of a 7-day period. So 7 days, you can see the egg, and then they close that thimble. And then another 7 days, the larvae develops and will emerge. And as soon as that bee emerges, as soon as that new queen emerges, half of the bees have gone with the old queen, and that's your swarm has left. And that's the way the colony reproduces. You know, it's a way of increasing the bee population, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but it does mean that you lose all of your workers.
Yes.
And so conventionally, you would try to avoid that happening. And there's lots of different ways of doing that. What I would tend to do is try and catch the swarm as it was about to happen and put it in a new box. So I've kind of allowed the natural process, but I've guided it so that I haven't lost all the bees. So that's kind of working with their kind of natural instincts, if you like. And there's also a lot of kind of debate around just letting them go as well. You know, there's a strong debate around that. For a long time, people felt that was creating a kind of feral population that were a bit of a source of pest and disease. But actually, what we've learned recently is that some of those feral colonies have been great at adapting to the pest and diseases, and have actually introduced stronger genetic, you know, material into the whole population. So there's a bit of a swing back towards allowing feral populations and supporting that kind of wilder aspect of the honeybees' lives. I've gone off on a tangent, have I?
It's just so interesting hearing you talk, and the kind of detail in your knowledge is amazing, Ken. So you were saying about time and commitment, Ken, a day a week. I'm surprised it's as little as that, but what more is there to say about time and commitment? Are there busy times, for example?
Well, it's a day in a week to do the kind of, I would say, the bare minimum in terms of if you're following the British Beekeeping Association, and I would recommend that for a beginner, just because I'm a strong advocate of finding the most natural way to look after the bees. But at its logical conclusion, it means not inspecting the hive. But the reason I advocate for the British Beekeeping Association approach to start with is because I think it's really important to learn what's happening inside the hive. And the only way you're going to do that is to look inside on a weekly basis through a whole season and actually over several seasons. If I thought that it was affecting the bees in a really detrimental way, I wouldn't do it. So I'm kind of comfortable with that level of intervention. I think if you follow some rules around the outside temperature and weather conditions, and you know, and listen to the bees as well. You know, if the bees are not enjoying the inspection, wrap it up. But I think it's the only way to really learn about what's going on inside the hive in a practical level. And that's, you know, that's once a week looking inside the hive. Then you've got dealing with the equipment, maybe dealing with a swarm, unexpectedly harvesting some honey, hopefully at some point. It's definitely a day a week. And there's no holidays as well from March till September. So that's, I think, one thing to consider is that I guess for serious gardeners and allotment holders, you take your holidays in the autumn or in the winter, perhaps. So it's very much that kind of yearly cycle.
How do you harvest the honey, Ken?
So with the kind of my approach of doing it, which is the sort of most conventional in the UK, is you put a box on top of the hive called a super, which has honeycomb in it, or it has frames which the bees build honeycomb on, and between the hive and this box called a super, you put what's called a queen excluder, and that has very specifically has bars of a very specific width, and only the worker bees can fit through. The queen is slightly too big to fit through. So what happens is the queen can't get up into that box to lay eggs. So the workers go up and they just fill it with nectar, and then they turn that nectar into honey. And it's a really nice way of you can then take the box off without disturbing the rest of the colony too much, I would say. I mean, it's obviously, they're going to notice you've taken their honey and they're going to have to produce some more. And so you need to be really conscious of how much you're taking and what time of year you're taking it, so they've got enough for the winter. I don't feed bees, so I always leave enough honey for them to get through the winter, which is, you know, leaving quite a large amount of honey. You have to be quite conservative if you're going to take that approach. I think that's the kind of time commitment. And also I have increasingly, I leave a fallow year as well. So every now and again, depending on what's happening with the bees, I won't harvest one year. I've noticed that sometimes I get a really good harvest off a particular hive, and then that can produce enough honey for whatever needs I've had, which may be honey for myself or honey for the community shop or something, like, depending on where I've been keeping the bees, for 2 or 3 years sometimes, depending on how you ration it. And so I think having a fallow year is also a really good practice.
And I was going to ask about location. I know people do keep bees in Hackney, and here we are in Norwich, surrounded by fields and possibly dodgy things going on the fields. I mean, I have heard that keeping bees in cities can actually be, just important, but they can do well in cities.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I got into it, for sure. There's a lot of people who have kind of acted on that, and central London has probably too many honeybees now. And there's restrictions across Europe as well, in some cities for beekeeping. So it's a case of being a kind of aware of who else is keeping bees in your local area, aware of what the land use is. It's a tricky thing, I think. The problems, I would never discourage someone from keeping bees. Even though there are, you know, there's a lot of honeybees in London, for instance, because the problem is the way that we look after the countryside, for sure. It's not whether people decide to keep bees or not, you know, that's not the cause of the problem. The cause of the problem is the use of pesticides and the destruction of habitat. So, I think it's just a bit of kind of understanding who else is keeping bees. But a lot of that, you'll get information from your local beekeeping association. Again, you know, just find out who else is keeping bees and what kind of crops and things are being planted in the local area.
And is it possible to approach a farmer or someone with land and do they welcome bees being kept on their land? Or because I know someone in North Norfolk who, and his bees produce the most lovely honey, which comes from the marsh. From the marshes, but he's allowed to keep bees on a field right on the edge of the marsh by a kind farmer. But is that a kind of practice that goes on? Is that unusual?
No, that is very. Commercial beekeepers actually don't make their money out of honey; they make it out of pollination contracts. That's pretty common around the world, I think. Farmers love having some bees on their land, it sounds like your friend maybe is a hobby, right? I'm sure the farmer's happy for them to have the bees in the corner of the field. But you know commercial fruit and veg growers will pay beekeepers to bring the hives for the flowering period, and that's where a lot of commercial beekeepers make their money.
Right. Oh, I didn't know that. That's fascinating. Mm. And in terms of kit, what sort of investment? I mean, a pretty substantial suit and hood.
Yeah. Especially for you.
Yeah. Yes. I'd put on three, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I've heard of people with allergies putting double suits.
Right.
I had an aggressive hive one year that I used to wear a boiler suit underneath. That was an interesting one. mostly you don't really get aggressive hives. You just get bad practice that the bees are responding to, but very occasionally you do get aggressive hives. And
is it a bit like a dog will reflect how it's looked after? I mean, will they respond to a kind of empathetic? I really like your approach, which sounds that you're trying to be as sustainable and as little intervention as possible, but things still need managing. And I mean, is there such a thing as happy bees and then unhappy bees if they're not looked after?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. But I guess what I was saying is that, you know, you get different breeds of dogs, and some breeds of dogs can have a temper.
Mm.
And so you can get some bees that naturally have a bit of a temper, but mostly it's about how they're kept.
Right.
And bees tend to, but then it's also, you know, I wouldn't want to blame if you come across a hive of angry bees, I wouldn't blame the beekeeper, because it could also be circumstances out of their control. Say a local farmer is spraying on the crops and the bees are reacting to that, or the weather's bad.
Right.
So there's lots of reasons why bees can get a bit angry, but this is a beekeeper with a very strong opinion. It's rarely because of genetics, but it can be. That's what I would say.
Well, that makes perfect sense, doesn't it? If they're living beings, that they're going to react to their environment and their conditions and behave accordingly, like all other living things, really. So that makes total sense.
Yeah. But I mean, it's it doesn't cost anything. Well, it does cost like a small subscription to join your local beekeeping association. And then if you want to go full in and buy all the kit new, you're looking at £1,000, I think, really, in terms of just getting yourself set up with maybe a hive and the kit, or maybe a couple of hives in the kit. I can't remember now. It's a long time since I did that. Probably, no doubt, all the costs have gone up.
Yes.
But I really like the idea of getting involved with the local beekeeping association, so you get some experience and rather than just diving in and seeing if you like it. And then progressing from there, is there any other advice you'd offer?
No, I mean, just enjoy the bees. You know, it's lovely to engage with their world. It's they experience the world in a completely different way to us, and they experience each other and their social workings, and it's fascinating. And I love it. It's a very different side to our food system than growing veg or growing flowers. It's so inextricably linked, and yet a completely different world. So yeah, it's a lovely thing to engage with. And you can do that just by sitting in amongst the flowers and watching them come and go. You'll be surprised, firstly, how many different types of pollinators you see, and secondly, how they all behave when they kind of interact with the flowers. It's quite cool.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful. Do you find, even when you're not with the bees, you're thinking about them, or you're thinking about the weather and what's going on? It's always there.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, and I've noticed I'm much more keenly aware of when things come into flower now, and like, oh, that's come, especially the ivy. I'm like, oh, the ivy's out, they'll love that. And then notice when they're all on the ivy, that's a lovely time of year.
And I've heard another friend who keeps bees talk about the difference between spring honey and autumn honey, but I know nothing about that. Can you explain, is there a difference? Is it in the flavour or maturity?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, you see sort of specialist honey, I think, in the shops where, you know, it's lavender or thyme, or, I mean, Manuka's the famous one. So, yeah, I think it's really interesting because, I mean, the majority of the honey will be similar, and there's a small percentage is different, and that comes from the different flowers that the bees have been visiting. A thyme honey has, you know, some medicinal properties that the bees actually tap into, for instance. So when the bees are feeling a bit poorly, they'll go and seek out thyme flowers. So you've got some patches of thyme on the allotment. Really nice, because if they're struggling with a cold, effectively the equivalent of a cold, then I'll go and seek out the thyme. But the spring honey tends to be a clear flow of you know, it's the clear runny honey that people traditionally valued more highly. And then the later you get in the year, and it's also when there tends to be traditionally when bees would be feeding on flowering trees, so apples and pears and cherries and things like that. And then later in the year, they would be on the meadows, so, you know, the smaller flowering plants. That's, I think, we don't really have that landscape anymore, so it's not necessary. It doesn't necessarily hold true. But the honey you get later in the year is kind of darker and thicker and will set more quickly. And especially if you think about the ivy definitely does that. It's kind of a brown, dark, dark honey that you get off the ivy. So yeah, but I mean, I don't tend to take, when I harvest the honey, it's probably a little bit of a mix of all of them, which is also nice.
I had a friend, well, I've got a friend who keeps bees, and he brings the honey into work every so often in batches for us to, just gives it away to us, which is wonderful. But he had two samples one year, one of the springtime sort of earlier honey and one of the stuff later on in the year. And you could really not only see the difference in the colour, but the taste was so distinctively different. And I can't remember what plants he said he'd noticed that they'd been largely visiting, but he could identify which flowers they'd mainly been eating and therefore where some of that flavour came from, and the sort of the earlier, more sort of spring, I don't know if it was springtime honey, but earlier in the year honey, tasted a lot lighter and sort of fresher somehow, which was super interesting because it makes total sense that what you eat sort of determines the flavour, but I hadn't really thought about it until then. So it's super interesting.
Yeah, that's exactly what a traditional spring honey would be like, yeah. Yeah, and then also what's fascinating is you can have two hives right next to each other and they will visit completely different sources of nectar. So, and because they make a decision as a colony where to get their nectar, honeybees don't take a kind of scattergun approach. They make a decision that we're going to harvest from that horse chestnut, and that's where they all go.
Yeah.
And so then you can have two hives right next to each other with producing honey that's different as well, which is cool.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So you can get different flavors from all your hives.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If one finds the apple orchard and the other finds a stand of lime trees, those two different honey from two different hives will taste completely different.
Mm.
Produced at exactly the same time of year in exactly the same place.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
I can see that. I can see how you really get into it. And I remember last year there was someone on the radio who was a honey sommelier, a special tasting honey, and she actually talked about how you should taste honey to really appreciate it, a bit like a really fine wine. But yeah, there's a whole world I can see it opening up. I wish we had a lot longer. It's fascinating.
Yeah. Ken, we should probably leave it there because I know. But just very quickly before we go, we did something with our previous special guest, Stephanie Hafferty, which was a take on Desert Island Discs. And Desert Island Allotment. So we're going to give you Joy Larcombe's vegetable book because that is the Bible. And then we'll give you a beehive because you'll be happy with one of those. What else? What other one item would you take to this desert island allotment?
Oh, a pair of binoculars, easy.
Good one. I was going to say, does it have to be a desert island? Can we put Ken on an island off Ireland or Scotland and
off Norfolk?
Norfolk.
I thought you were going to ask my top five veg. Like, what five veg if I had to take five veg?
No, binoculars is a great answer.
Very good.
Okay. Yeah, brilliant. Well, thank you very much, Ken. That was fascinating.
Really fascinating.
Thanks, guys. Nice to meet you, Rachel.
Yeah, you too. Thank you.
Well, that was really interesting. Thanks again to Ken for taking the time to talk to us. I feel like I learned a lot about bees and other pollinators and the wider context and sort of environmental concerns, and it was really inspiring. Just super interesting. I feel like I want to go away and learn loads more about bees and other pollinators now. What did you guys think?
Yeah, that environmental aspect of it I thought was really interesting. I expected a conversation solely about bees, but we ended up having a conversation about flowers, the environment and politics. And I thought that was fascinating, really. And I think I realised I can do more than I thought I could before I spoke to Ken. I'm not going to be a beekeeper, but I can let parts of my allotment grow. I can let things go to seed, and I could buy some flowers of different varieties that can be useful for not just bees, but all pollinators. So, yeah, I thought that was, genuinely really inspiring. What do you think, Peter?
Oh, absolutely the same. And I think it's impossible now to talk about gardening and allotments without seeing it was in the wider context of climate change and the threats to species. So I was absolutely knocked out by we've got Lara in tow with us recording today on, and I just thought it was absolutely inspiring, his level of knowledge and how considered he was about seeing bees within the wider context. The same takeaways for me, and as always, leaving nettles around the apple tree, and just not having that, just remembering wildlife all the time as part of our gardening practice, rather than being obsessed about the growing things. It is about the whole plot of land and
absolutely
what it can do.
Yeah, I think it's really wonderful, this sort of increased awareness and discussion around wildlife and the environment in which we garden and grow things, because it's a clear shift from when I was younger even, and I grew up with very sort of organic focused parents who cared a lot about this, and when we grew things we tried to consider those things, but it feels far more widespread. And I feel like in the last 5 years I've learnt so much more about just what seem like very small things that you can do, like not cutting back all of your stems on perennial plants in the autumn but leaving them in the winter, but that are really important for wildlife and insects to have a home. And I think talking to people like Ken or Stephanie the other week and Joy, like, it's all really inspiring and makes me have a bit of hope, I think, for the future, that more people are aware.
It's so important that whilst we love the allotments and we love gardening, we are, of course, aware of the threats that exist, and they can be scary, but we also have to know we can all make a difference. We can all do our part, and that's incredibly important. And that's also where I don't want to be overwhelmed by anxiety about these things. And that's where we can do something positive. And that's where, exactly as you say, Rachel, that's where hope lives. And we need hope, and hope is important. And seeing gardening within that wider context encourages me enormously.
Good. Yeah. I feel exactly the same.
Yeah, so thank you, Ken. That was just a brilliant reminder about all of those things, but we can all do our bit.
Yes.
And what is that bird?
Oh, I don't know.
I hear it all the time, but I've never identified it. It reminds me of a fish eagle, but it can't possibly yeah, can't be a fish eagle.
It did sound more like a bird of prey. Anyway.
And with that, thank you and goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.